Mother Earth says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, hey, yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo. And Father Sky says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, hey, yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo. Say, take good care of us. Please do not hurt us. Hey, hey, yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo. And we are here to be ourselves, to be with one another, to be our surroundings, to be. And we are here to take care of ourselves, to take care of one another, to take care of our surroundings, take care, to care. Nahastan anila nijane ga shabothya, nijane ga shabothya. Hey, hey, yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo. Hey, hey, yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo.
Akwe, greetings. You are listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yat Kiddushi Native American Center. We are broadcasting on RFPI, Radio for Peace International, Global Community Radio. Akwe, welcome. This is your host, Ones Pritzker. Wolf Mountain Radio focuses on protecting Mother Earth, defending native lands and indigenous peoples throughout the world. Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices presents the situations facing Native peoples throughout the world with Native news, interviews, music, commentaries, and investigative reports. This program serves to protect sacred Mother Earth and the traditional cultural lifeways of Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Please listen now to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. Ho, Kanamatakwasin, to all of our relations. music from Anishinaabe Lakota musician flutist Kevin Locke from Kevin Locke's Red Feather Music CD entitled Midnight Strong Heart. And the name of that song was Wania, an honor song to the chickadee bird. Ashkwe, greetings and hello, everyone. Welcome to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. Kevin Locke is not only a gifted musician, but is a well-respected teacher. He holds a master's degree in education. Kevin Locke has also traveled many places in the world, sharing his music and concerns for peace and social justice. Many listeners may not know that he is also a member of the Baha'i Faith, which advocates universal peace and respect for all peoples. Recently, I had the pleasure to visit with Kevin again during a trip he made to Southwest Florida in order to perform at local schools and meet with fellow Baha'is, such as my friend and today's program guest, Mr. Eugene Purnell. Eugene and I have been friends for many years. We first met years ago when a number of us came together in order to establish a Southwest Florida Social Justice Council in order to deal with many racial issues facing our community. Eugene is an African-American brother who, although grew up in the bigotry and segregated South, has risen above this to become a world citizen, concerned for the rights of all peoples. Eugene Purnell comes from Memphis, Tennessee, on the banks of the Mississippi River. His life experience has been like the blues music he listens to. Eugene has picked cotton and field crops, worked on the docks as a longshoreman, been a shrimp fisherman, worked construction, and is a trained mechanic. Throughout all this, Eugene has self-studied many world religions. His philosophy and worldview is very enlightening. In today's program, Eugene and I share a wide-ranging conversation, which I'm sure our Wolf Mountain Radio worldwide listeners will find very interesting. Eugene, there are a number of topics I want to ask you about, such as the issues of culture and race, civil rights, social justice, spiritual beliefs, which I know we will discuss. However, as a way of beginning our conversation, I'm going to ask you to first talk about your experience while working at the Chuscaloosa State Park in friendship with your Choctaw friend, Mr. Grady John. Eugene, welcome to Wolf Mountain Native Radio.
Thank you for having me on this. This is a pleasure. This is something that I'm happy to talk about, and I'm happy to have this written in the annals of time. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. And there we have a museum, I think the only one in that area that I was aware of, and that's Shelby County, out near Fuller State Park, T.O. Fuller State Park. The Chuscaloosa Museum is located. 78, 79, I worked at the Chuscaloosa Museum for a reasonably short amount of time. I have so many beautiful memories of the people. When I went there, my curiosity was toward the mound builders of that area and that era. I think it goes back something like 1100 something. The things that stand out in my mind are the beauty and the simplicity of the people that I met. Simplicity in that it was natural. It was natural. They showed me things that, you know, we have all this materialism in our heads, and we think that life is so complex, and it's not. I met Grady John. He was the chairman, I think, of that council, and his wife, Betty. Well, I've heard recently that Grady John had passed, too. He's the first person that I really got close to relate to, and he and I would talk, and he would always tell me, Eugene, you ain't going to do right. That was his saying. You know, you ain't going to do right. That's the way he put it. He was a potter. I started being interested in how native peoples made utensils, because this is what he did. So after I got my work done, I would sit and watch him. He explained the processes, and then he asked me if I would go with him to collect clay. So we did. We went, and he showed me how clay was on, you know. Chuscaloosa is located on a bluff. And, of course, at the bottom of that bluff is the Mississippi River Delta. So the sides of the hills were full of clay. And he would go, and he would collect 5-gallon buckets of clay. I'd help him carry it, of course. And we'd go back to the museum, he'd put water in it, then soak it, and then strain it through a screen and into another bucket, and then pour the water off. And at the bottom of the bucket was the clay that he would use. I saw the process. He would sit and roll out long strings of clay, just roll them out, and then build his utensils on the table. And as he built them, he would smooth them out, keep building up, until he made whatever form it was, whether it was a pot, whether it was a plate, or whatever it was. And then he would smooth that out and let it dry. Once it dried, then he would take a sharp object, anything, a stick, whatever he had, a pencil, knife, and then he would etch his designs in it. And you could see that he had done this for a long time. He had practiced his craft. After he etched it, then we'd go to his house. Out in his front yard, he had a pit dug. And in that pit, he would put stones, and then he would put the fire building materials, you know, wood, whatever was available, which was, of course, this was a forest park area, and he would use the wood. Sit to work. Once the fire got going and the rocks got hot, then he would sit the pieces inside the pit and then put the cover back on them. And the next day, he pulled out the product. And they were beautiful. Beautiful work. Of course, you know, he made some money, too, you know. People bought it. Grady John and his wife, Betty, and I think at that time they had two children. I'm not sure, but I think I remember a boy and a girl. I was curious about everything. You know, being an employee, I could go in the back rooms. I could go where the stuff that they didn't have on the exhibit. I could see that was tobacco there that, of course, they had grown it. They grew it, rather, but they grew it from original seed. I made the mistake of, you know, because at the time I was a heavy smoker, and I made the mistake of rolling up some of that old Indian tobacco. Boy, what you talking about? It was powerful. I never had anything that strong. But anyway, I couldn't take too much of it. The museum life was curious in one respect, and it was sad in another respect. The sadness was that it didn't come until later years that I realized the sacredness of those grounds. The exhibit, of course, goes into burial chambers, and you see the bones of the original peoples of that era. I learned quite a bit there. There was a huge field in the center of the, I guess, I don't know whether you call it a compound or not, but a village. And you could go into areas where there had been original peoples, fireplaces, what have you. And you could see the old shards and the old carbon deposits and stuff that were left from the fires. It was very, very beautiful. Very beautiful to me. You can see the... I hesitate to use the word chief because I'm not so familiar with native customs and mores. But you could see the chief's mound. It was huge. It was, of course, the tallest thing there. And it was pyramidal shape. Standing on the chief's mound, you look out like... If you can imagine a football field, you could look out from one end zone to the other. Around the sidelines, they had things like corn crib. And this corn crib was, the way it was constructed was, the simplicity of it was beautiful to me because they had thatch roofs and they were on poles and, of course, and wooden sides. And they put the corn in, loaded it up, and then they greased the poles so the animals couldn't get to it. This was how they preserved their corn or maize. At that time, I was unaware of the games that were being played, as far as the reason why you had this field. Maybe it was for dancing. I don't know. I had a chance to see the first forerunner to the spear. And I think the name, if I remember correctly, is called Atlatl. Yes, Atlatl. I saw that, and I saw the way that the feathers were used and the beauty of it, and some of the symbolism stayed, but not much, because at that time I had, you know, I'm in Memphis, Tennessee, the home of a lot of oppression. I had just had a epiphany in my life, and a lot of things were on my mind. But I'm so happy you let me relate this experience, because I want you to know that these people were very good friends of mine. We were close. One of the elders there, Mr. Woodbell, he stands out in my mind more than anything, because he was around 60 years old. He and I got together, I think, because as a person, as a mechanic, I was always, you know, fixing something. And he had some car trouble, and I remember fixing his car, and then we began to have friends. We went to eat, and after that, we were pretty close. So around the museum one day, he came and he said, Eugene, would you like to do some work with me, help me out? I said, yeah, sure. So he says, I'll pay you, I think it was 25 cents for each cane that you cut. Cane meaning river cane, you know, like bamboo, a small version of bamboo that grows in the swamplands in Tennessee, in that bluff area, in that delta area. So I said, you know, to myself, I said, whoa, you know, 20 cents a piece? Yeah, sure, let's go. So we jumped in his station wagon and we took off. We had a couple of butcher knives and that's it. So we went down the road, we went over to the bluff, walked the railroad tracks approximately, maybe we walked a quarter of a mile or a half mile. We went down this hill into this little swampy area. The cane was just as thick as hairs on your head. And we started cutting. I remember him showing me, you know, how to lay it out. You put all the big ends on one end, the little ends, the tips all on the same end. Where we made bundles that were approximately, if you put your hands together and hold your elbows out, they were approximately that big. I mean, I have pretty long arms. So this was a pretty heavy load. I mean, I don't know how many, maybe 100, I don't know. But there were quite a few stalks of cane. And what stands out in my mind is that we had come down a hill approximately 18 or 20 feet. And this, you know, it's not straight up, of course, not vertical, but pretty steep. We bundled these bundles up. We wrapped them up. And I remember seeing him pick up his end, the small end of his bundle, and he bent over and backed up under it and locked his arms and his hands behind him around the bundle and bent over and walked up the hill with it. Now, this is a 60-year-old man. And so here I am. You know, I'd never done it before. But I'm young and I'm strong, so, you know, I think I was in my 30s. And I got mine up the hill, too, behind him, but quite a ways behind him. When I got to the top of the hill, he was, oh, I don't know, 30 yards down the railroad track. He did not stop. He did not hesitate. He didn't rest. He kept going. And we walked back to the station wagon. And when I got there, his bundle was tied down. He was waiting on me. Now, this man was 60-some years old at that time. So, you know, little things like that in your life, people, when you're passing through this world, things stand out. And that stood out in my mind more so than anything that, as far as Native people are concerned. Of course, later on, I had a chance to meet Native peoples like yourself, like Kevin Locke, who we just got through talking about, the hoop dancer from Dakotas. I became aware of the reservations in that area. When I went through Mississippi, I began to become aware of Choctaws and the Choctaw Reservation. But I know in that area, there were Choctaw, Chickasaw, and...
Some Creek.
No, the Cherokees were not there.
A few, but mostly in Georgia and the Carolinas. But Mississippi was mostly Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek.
And Creek. Well, I'll say that I remember his smile. I remember his laugh. And I miss the old man. One thing that kept him in my mind, and that funny how, you know, spiritual things work. I went through some tribulations not too long ago. I made a serious mistake, and it reminded me. I went back to him. When I went to visit him years later, here's what happened. I went on the museum grounds looking for him, and he was at his little booth there where he sold his tomahawks and things that he made out of the cane. He sold little flutes and tomahawks and put a little feather and a little paint on them, and he made a good living. But he was sad, and I said, "What's wrong with you?" And he said that his sister had passed. And I remembered that his sister and he had lived together, you know, with each other for years, all their lives, I imagine. So at that time, for some reason, we talked about making big decisions, financial decisions or just major decisions, life, you know, major decisions. And he, for some reason, he told me that his custom was that at the time of a loss like he had suffered, his tradition was not to make any decisions for a certain amount of time. This is how they did it. So hadn't gone. He was always a traveler, going places, riding, seeing things, and he had not done any of that. This was his period of mourning.
Grandfather, teach me all about you.
from Native American band Spirit Wing from their CD Ancient Spirit Voices. The name of that song was Grandfather, an honor song to our elders' knowledge and wisdoms. You are listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yad Kiddushi Native Center. This is your host and producer, Ones Pritzker. My guest today is Mr. Eugene Purnell. Eugene is a longtime friend of mine who is here in the studio sharing some of his insights with us from his life experiences growing up in the racially segregated South. Eugene, in today's program introduction, I mentioned that we first met years ago when a number of us in Southwest Florida came together to deal with serious racial issues that were occurring in the state of Florida, which unfortunately still exists many years later. As people of color, we both experience prejudice and know all too well the long history of injustices people of color have suffered. This is why Yad Kiddushi Native Center works so hard for social, economic, and environmental justice. This brings us to the subject of what in English is called civil rights. I remember in my youth the hatred and violence of white racists fighting against my native people's tribal fishing rights. Many listeners to Wolf Mountain Radio know that part of the reason why the American Indian Movement was established was to protect our Indian people from police brutality and harassment by non-Indian people towards our native community. In many ways, the history of racism towards Native America is similar to the prejudice and racism experienced by black people. Eugene, would you please talk about your experiences growing up as a black man in America? I know you were in Memphis during the time which our beloved Dr. Martin Luther King was murdered at the Lorraine Hotel. Please share any thoughts you have on this subject.
Well, thank you so much. Ones, this is a subject that's dear to my heart. Also, it's been a subject that I have most of the time since the 60s. We got caught up in, what's the word, when you fight for all the civil advances and then the repercussions come back on you to make it negative. The way that I'm speaking now, Ones, you have to understand that I had a 180-degree turn in my life, my spiritual life. It did not mean that I put away these truths. These are truths. These are very important events in my life, in my spiritual well-being. At that time, I had gone to Nashville. I attended Tennessee State University for a very short time. Being a street person, I was always very, very much aware of the civil rights movement. I was always involved in combating racism, always, always, all my life up to this day. Sometimes it puts you in a lot of trouble, but other times when you look around and you see all the notables and the people who have given their lives and the young people of today who are fighting these same battles like they are in New Orleans, you can see the worth of it. But we're not going to get the critic in the print. It's not going to be any books printed about, oh, how wonderful Eugene's life was because he was this or that. Or any of the, not too many of the other people. The millions and millions of people are concerned about civil rights. Glad you reminded me that you have a worldwide audience. I will try as best as I can to relate the 2 days of our terror. The first day was the day when we knew that Dr. King was in town and he was there to help the garbage men, the people on the bottom of the totem pole in that city. And they did the dirtiest work. We had a situation where the union was holding out. They were fighting a battle. And things had become pretty hectic and pretty heated and pretty oppressive because the system there, the system in Memphis at that time in Shelby County, you know, like in many parts of the world today, you know, this is my side, that's your side. This is your place, this is my place. This is the way. And at that time, the stereotypes were in everybody's mind. Everybody had them because we had lived that way. You know, that's Mr. So-and-so, that's their place over there. We knew where our real estate boundaries were. We didn't know what redlining was because we weren't aware of it. But we knew that we had to live on so-called, quote, this side of the track. Yeah, so at that time, if I remember correctly, a little bit prior to that, I had came back from Nashville. I hadn't learned my way, you know, the error of my ways at that time. I was still running the streets. Right before these events occurred, my mother, who knew of Dr. King, I knew of Dr. King, but I also knew of Malcolm. And to me, Malcolm was being young and, you know, when you listen to somebody who's a great orator and a firebrand as he was, it was quite inspiring. It uplifted a lot of us young people. But the elders knew better. They knew and they saw the way that Dr. King was going. Well, at that time, I couldn't see it. I'll never forget that. She's dead and gone, but we argued one night. It's a two-bedroom house. And I'm in one bedroom, she's in the other, the doors are open, and we're arguing about who I should be really listening to. She was trying to teach me, and I wouldn't listen. For me, Malcolm, what Malcolm was saying made sense, you know. The ballad of the bullet, you know, and these kinds of phrases. And she was talking about loving each other, loving thy neighbor as thyself. We cannot hate. Love overpowers hate. At that time, of course, in my ignorance, I could not see it. I remember now hearing that there was going to be a speech at the Masonic Temple. I think it was on Hernando in Memphis. In that area, we had what you call, our president at the time, Lyndon Johnson, would call urban renewal. But of course, everybody there knew that it was urban removal, because all of the cultural places, meeting places, the good time places, the bad time places, whatever you want to call it, all of the businesses, all of the role models had businesses. There was insurance companies, there were banks, there were all of these things. Urban renewal had wiped out. At that time, I was in a lounge with my buddies and my girlfriend. I remembered that Dr. King was giving a speech. So I asked everybody, you know, whoever who wanted to go out to the car with me to listen to the speech. And nobody, so I went out by myself. I remember I had a little Volkswagen, so I sat there and leaned the seat back and I listened. When Dr. King finished, I was choked up. I couldn't. I understand now what he means when he's been to the mountaintop and he sees the promised land. The promised land that he's talking about is what we will have to have here to be able to be the dawning light, the shining light for the world that we are destined to be. We are here in all of this turmoil that we're going through in this time, 2006. Those of you who are depressed and you feel hopeless and you're looking at all this idiocy, know that out of all of this, the ground is being plowed. And the seeds of hope are everywhere. There are young people. I'm so happy to know that the majority, the vast majority of my white brothers and sisters understand what's going on, and they understand the necessity for unity. And we're all pulling together. Let me collect myself. At the end of his speech, I remember being so affected, I sat there for a long time. I went back in and I gave my little understanding of what I heard. Of course, I had good friends who listened to me all the time, but you know, I was always rattling on about injustice. I just made it up in my mind the next day that I was going to go to this march that was planned. Around the time when I knew that the march was about ready to begin, I had climbed on the back of a flatbed trailer. And you know how when a person is, before a person passes on to the next world, they have a lot of stress lines and wrinkles and worry lines, and where their life has taken its toll on their face. And then if you'll notice, if you have paid attention to this at all, when a person has the time to reconcile themselves to death, in the end, their faces is smooth as a baby's. There are no worries. and these are the blessed, you know, the ones who are not, they don't die violently all of a sudden or something, you know. So I was standing there, and he was approximately 20, 30 feet away. I saw the other notables, but my eyes were focused on Dr. King. I think, of course, Jesse Jackson was there. He was a young man. Reverend Abernathy, Reverend Lowry, they were there. But I was focused on Dr. King. He had a nice suit on. He had his hat, you know, beautiful hat, dress hat. And his face was as smooth as, and he had an expression on his face. It was not an expression of happy anticipation. It was not an expression of sadness. It was an expression of resolve. I saw a person who had set his face. He had resolved himself and set his goal, and he was not going to be turned around. You know, when he went by me, of course, there was a long line of people behind him. And they made the turn to go from, I think that was Linden. I'm not sure now. Don't get me wrong. The next street over was Beale. And Beale Street was where black cultural life, the nightlife and that type of life, and a lot of black businessmen, black doctors and what have you. This was the part of town where everybody went, you know. On the weekends, this place was jumping. There was something going on all the time. I fell in behind in the march, fell in behind as they went by. We went down, I think it was Hernando, to Beale, turn, and people were chanting, and everybody was happy. We're doing something. We're part of this movement, you know. We were around 4th Street, and we went across 3rd Street, and almost to 2nd, and of course Main was the next street, and the march had turned the corner on Main, so we were around 2nd, somewhere between all the tailor shops and stuff. At that point, I heard an explosion. Then all of a sudden, people are running, coming back our way, and you know, we're trying to figure out, well, what's wrong? What happened? Evidently, somebody threw something, broke some glass, and that was enough to trigger all the repression. We all had to run. There were hundreds of people. We were running. We ran through the alleyways, and we made it to another little lounge that I knew of on Linden. We made it to a little lounge across from where Universal Life Insurance Company is today. But when we made it to the lounge, we all went inside, and by that time, you know, people who knew one another were together, and I was in a crowd of people that I knew. It was about 6 or 7, 8 of us, so we were inside the lounge talking about the events. Then approximately 20 minutes later, one of the riot policemen came through the door and with his gun. The gun was pointed up, of course. He didn't point the gun at us. And he said that, hey, you know, you got to shut it down. He told the owner, he said, you got to shut it down, and everybody's got to go. So come on out, everybody out. So as we were going out, we saw that there were 4 or 5 officers standing in the streets. There were 4 or 5 officers around the building, and they were ushering us, you know, to our cars. Well, a couple of the guys were highly upset. I can't remember the young man's name. I had met him and knew him. He got beat pretty bad. He was bloody. People were, you know, we were all upset, but we knew that these guys, we were surrounded. There were guys with guns ready, and we were surrounded, so the crowd broke up. We all went to our cars, and one of the policemen escorted me to my car. And I'll never forget, go on, get in. So I opened the door, a little Volkswagen, and I looked out. I was looking at his face as I was closing the door, and I looked him straight in the eye. This guy, I didn't have fear. I didn't know at the time how I felt, except that it was like a cold assessment of what was happening and what was going on. I closed the door, and I cranked up. I pulled out. I got on Bellevue, which is now called Elvis Presley Boulevard. I got on Bellevue, and I went north. And I went north to Hyde Park, where I lived, down Chelsea to the neighborhood. I knew that there was nobody at my house. My mother was probably still at work. My stepfather was at work. So I went by my girlfriend's house to share with her what had happened and her family. They had a big family, too. I remember talking, telling them, describing what had happened, and we sat there and we related the events. And then all of a sudden, the newscast came on. It broke into the middle of a program. The TV was on there. And it was Walter Cronkite. And he said, "We've just got breaking news that Dr. King has just been assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee."
Spirits that came from heaven that gathered round him when he died, and all the white folks talked about him. And Miss Coretta, she cried. Some have dreams and some see visions, but there are few who walk the talk. Martin, the light shone all around you as you led them through the dark. And they might kill one lonely preacher, but they will never kill the man. There is still the walk towards freedom. Footsteps of one black African. Stoned him down in Selma, locked him in a cell in Birmingham, just like a man he admired, born long ago in Bethlehem. He sent the call to all the people against the ways of the Ku Klux Klan. He gave his life for the children and for the future of a troubled land. And they might kill one lonely preacher, but they will never kill the man. There is still the walk towards freedom. Footsteps of one black African. I kill one lonely creature. But they will never kill the man. There is still the walk towards freedom. Footsteps of one black.
You are listening to Yatkidichi Native Center's Honoring Mother Earth and Indigenous Voices. Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices focuses on protecting Mother Earth and defending Native lands and Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices presents the situations facing Native peoples throughout the world with Native news, interviews, music, commentaries, and investigative reports. This program serves to protect sacred Mother Earth and the traditional cultural lifeways of Indigenous peoples. We are broadcasting on Radio for Peace International. Radio for Peace is the voice of peace, promoter of the environment, champion of human rights, denouncer of hate and injustice, advocate of the oppressed, defender of truth. Radio for Peace International is global community radio.
Deep in the valley of mothers, black mining slavery will offer a world of riches, a wealth of diamonds and of gold to fill the boys and the scoffers. Because my children hunger, we can abide no longer. We will abide no longer until this nation's a free land. Mandela, Mandela, apartheid's prison walls will never hold you because you are Mandela, the inspiring in the spirit of Mandela. These white man's comforts spring from the tears of my mothers, extracted from my people's blood and sweat distilled, creating purpose for others. Yet from this river of tears, a fighting prophet will appear. Oh, a strong and fighting prophet appears to liberate our stolen land. Fighting bravely to assure apartheid's reign will soon be over. And no man they have been slain, these Jews won't have died in vain. We will remember every name as we march on to victory. Mandela, we are the martyrs of Sharpeville. We are the heroes of Soweto. We are the
Music from the All People's Singers Band, who performed that honor song to African National Congress warrior Nelson Mandela during a historic ANC American Indian Movement national tour to free Nelson Mandela and Native American political prisoner Leonard Peltier, which Wolf Mountain Radio had the privilege to serve as one of the national ANC AIM press secretaries 20 years ago in our work to fight against apartheid. Prior to our Yad Kiddushi Native Center program identification, we featured the music of Native American singer-songwriter Mitch Walking Elk from his Peace with Dignity cassette. The name of that honor song to Dr. Martin Luther King was entitled Footsteps of One Black African. Well, dear friends, we're nearing the end of our broadcast time together for this edition of Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. I want to again sincerely thank my friend, Eugene Purnell, for sharing his thoughts with us today in Wolf Mountain Radio. Please listen next week for program 2 of my conversation with Eugene. We shall conclude today's program with the Leonard Peltier honor song from American Indian Movement co-founder Dennis Banks' cassette entitled Still Strong, which Dennis gifted me when he came to Southwest Florida in order to speak during the Bring Peltier Home National Speaking Tour, which Yad Kiddushi Native Center co-hosted with the independent traditional Seminoles here in Pahayogi, now called Southwest Florida, 10 years ago. Leonard Peltier has now been falsely imprisoned by the U.S. FBI for the past 30 years. Please help free Leonard Peltier by supporting Leonard Peltier's official defense committee. Their website is www.freeleonardpeltier.org. Once again, please help free Leonard Peltier by supporting Leonard's official defense committee. Their website is www.freeleonardpeltier.org. You can also find out more information about Leonard Peltier's case and other Native American struggles by visiting Yad Kiddushi Native Center's website. Our website is www.yadkiddushi.org. Thank you for listening to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. This is your host and producer, Ernest Pritzker. Aho, kinan wantakwasin to all of our relations.